This series of interviews is with Porter F. Butts, the noted and longtime director of the Wisconsin Union. It's being conducted by Donna Taylor in Mr. Butts' office in the Union, beginning on August 2, 1979. I think I'd like to start this morning, Mr. Butts, with some information from you about your early years, where you were born and grew up, how you came to the university, and maybe a little bit about your undergraduate days here.
All right. My birthplace was Pena, Illinois, a small coal mining town near Springfield, Illinois. That was birth date 1903, and we stayed there only 3 or 4 years and moved to Springfield. And so my early school education was all in Springfield, Illinois, primary school, high school, etc. And for whatever reason, possibly as much as anything due to the influence of my father, who was a very busy and active person, I guess I became what you would say was a doer outside as well as inside the classroom. So in high school I found myself as I went through the years of high school, active on the basketball team, president of the chemistry club, president of the high school debating society, president of sort of other minor organizations, active in musical shows of the high school, and Friday morning assemblies at translated means partly singing in a school quartet, and after school hours playing in a school orchestra and an independent pickup dance band.
What did you play? What instrument?
Playing in school plays.
What instrument did you play?
Pardon?
What instrument did you play in the orchestra?
Well, I started playing what was called a banjo ukulele, which is an unheard of instrument these days, and then moved on to clarinet and saxophone, and actually earned part of my way later on in college days playing in a dance orchestra during the summer season back home. Well, this was all what was known then and still is as extracurricular activity, but not, I guess, at the sacrifice of the schoolwork, because I turned out to be valedictorian of my senior class and gave a valedictory speech at the commencement time and so on. But I was very school oriented and activity oriented. Anything that had to do with life at the high school was for me. In fact, when the First World War armistice was signed in 1918, and the whole town was celebrating this spectacular occasion, and all the schools were closed for that purpose, I went to high school as usual and was very disoriented and disappointed that the school wasn't open. I didn't know why. In short, I hadn't kept track of national events. I was locally involved in the ongoing daily dozen at high school. I wandered back downtown to find out where everybody was about this big armistice celebration going on, which maybe is a kind of a clue to my instinct for liking to participate in whatever the school had to offer, whether inside or outside the classroom. Well, then came the time, of course, of graduation and trying to decide on college. And my brother had gone to the University of Illinois and was not enchanted with it, left. We did not, therefore, want to go back to Illinois, so we took a family tour to the Midwestern universities, several of the Big Ten universities, Indiana, Purdue, Michigan, Chicago, and then Illinois. And in fact, on one hot summer day, I actually enrolled in the University of Michigan, thinking that was going to be it, and my brother with me. But on our way home, we stopped at a friend's house in Illinois, Bloomington, Illinois. And the friend, this was a friend of my father, had a son who was a Wisconsin student. And the Badger yearbook was on the table. He wasn't there, the son wasn't. But there was the book. And they asked, had we thought about Wisconsin? Well, we hadn't at all. But turning the pages of the Badger and seeing these lovely lakes and hills and scenic pleasures that Madison and the campus offered stimulated a very immediate and strong interest on the part of a couple of young chaps who had grown up in the hot cornfields.
That's right.
of Illinois and had never been exposed to a waterland of any kind. So we thought, well, if you can go to school where it's pleasant, there's a lake on the campus shore, why not go there, at least for the first year, after which we would go to Princeton. Because in those days, you couldn't enroll in Princeton without 4 years of Greek and Latin, and I only had 2 years. But Princeton would admit you upon showing a good record at a first year at an accredited major university elsewhere.
Oh, they would.
So the whole intent was to go to Wisconsin for 1 year and then hopefully transfer to Princeton.
Why Princeton particularly?
Pardon?
Why Princeton?
Princeton because of some friends in Springfield who were Princeton graduates and who had encouraged it. We respected them, knew them, and Princeton was a kind of a magic word in the collegiate field then, as it is now, and liberal arts was its emphasis, of course, and we had no specialty in mind as a profession or vocation. So I think it was the influence of knowing particular friends who told us about Princeton.
I see.
Well, then on to Madison, Wisconsin, which was a 2-day drive by automobile, trying to seek out the proper turns in the road. No highways were marked in those days except by symbols on telephone poles, the Black Diamond Trail, Cannonball Trail, the Liberty Trail, and so on. And you had to watch carefully to see where that trail, where that road turned.
Did you have maps?
How it led on into Wisconsin, but we got here.
Did you have maps?
And
road maps?
Pardon?
Were they road maps?
Of a kind, not very precise and not all that helpful. But my father had been assistant postmaster back in Payne, Illinois, and he knew where towns were in northern Illinois, at least, like the back of his hand. And so he would say, well, Rockford must be about 30 miles up there and a little to the left.
That was a help.
And so on. Well, we got to Madison, and since we were socially minded and had an uncle. My name, I'm his namesake, in fact. Porter Paddock was his name. He was a member of Phi Gamma Delta fraternity, so he had written ahead to introduce us to the local chapter of his national fraternity. And we just assumed that very likely a fraternity living situation was where we would end up. But we didn't, because we didn't get invited. And this is one of the first indications, at least perhaps for your archives' benefit, of how student life was in the early 1920s at Wisconsin. The Greeks, so-called, the fraternity and sorority people, were the dominant social group, political group, active group on the campus, though there numbered only 600 out of maybe 7,000 or 8,000 students. And the other some thousands of students were rather depreciatingly called barbarians or barbs, which was the custom that day. We now call them, or did in years after, independents. The fraternities and sororities had ample and rather posh buildings for chapters, for living and dining and social life. And independents or barbs did what they could to find a rooming house accommodations, and dining up and down the street at hamburger joints, and there was one cafeteria down on State Street, and Lawrence's restaurant on State Street was a kind of a general gathering place for everybody for breakfast and late evening snacks and so on. But the so-called independents or barbs led a pretty thin kind of existence, because at that time in the 20s, and presumably before I came to, there were literally no general meeting places, no university provisions for housing. Dormitories hadn't happened yet, except for one women's dormitory, Chadwin Hall. And there were no university provisions for food service, except a tea room over in Lake Paul, frequented mainly by the faculty, by girls. And so there was literally no way to find fellow students or to fraternize with them or to meet together in club groups or social groups, except if someone was aggressive enough to find a classroom that was empty to meet in. And this was an especially painful experience for anyone who had hoped to be associated with a fraternity or sorority.
Were you quite disappointed that you didn't?
They were high prestige groups in those days, and in the case of the girls, in particular, if they were not bid or pledged, there was deep sorrow, tears. Many girls left school pretty soon because they felt rejected and were unable to establish a reasonable social life on their own.
How did you and your brother feel about it?
Well, we were quite disappointed. We were huddled up in a little first floor room in a rooming house over on Dayton Street that had been converted into a bedroom and shared a bath with some of the other family members of that house. Rather dreary, it really was. And we shortly found that our existence consisted of moving from our rooming house to class and back, and with a detour for breakfast somewhere, and lunch and so on, wherever we could find it. And the disappointment was quite real. And since we both had been presidents of our senior class, my brother as well as myself, and highly socially motivated and active, this sudden isolation was a new experience and a little frightening, I must say. Well, it didn't last long because one of the fraternities that didn't seem to be attracted to us as members. One or two of the members of it nevertheless told another fraternity that we were on the loose, and that fraternity, which needed members rather badly to fill their partly empty house, came around and did ask us to join, and we did, and so this established us as part of the what was really the mainstream of student life.
Which fraternity was this?
Alpha Tau Omega. And in the end I became president of that too, which is I guess another indication of almost anything I seem to have gotten exposed to, I kept up with and continued in. And the fraternity was indeed helpful, not only to us, but all its members, as freshman members, as was the custom in those days, in effect pushing them into university activity, because it was supposed to reflect favorably on the fraternity if their members were out doing things and reaching some place of recognition on the campus, and all the fraternities throughout used to spell this out to all their prospective members that we have members who are active on the football team, and lead the publications, on the union board or whatever, you see. So it was self-interest partly on the part of the fraternity, but it was also, rather gratuitous and nevertheless very helpful nudge for a stranger like myself, because this campus was totally new and foreign to me. We had no other friends of any kind, no contacts that represented a point of reference to ask questions, even. So one of the early things the fraternity apparently did, in our case, they noticed that we both sang and had been in variety shows in high school, so on, and they got us to try out for what was called Union Vaudeville, V-O-D-V-I-L. And I mention this because it does represent my first, very first original contact with something called a union. This was in the fall of my freshman year.
And that was?
1920. And for whatever reason, we were in the tryouts, we were accepted as one of the acts. Union Vaudeville was the union board's, one of the union board's many means of raising money to build the union building. This was not all that apparent to me at the time, but it right off made me aware that there was such a thing as a union and an active union board, and indeed I was adopted as one of the acts of the show. And this was just the year following Frederick March's spectacular success in Unionville, which we had heard about. We didn't know he was going to be all that famous at that time, but we heard a good deal about Frederick March, Frederick Bickle, he was known at the time. And you know what happened to Frederick March from there on.
Oh, yes.
As you know, 50 years after this building opened, we have dedicated our small theater to Frederick March, and partly because he got his first start in the theatrical world in Union Vaudeville, and indeed was a member of the Union Board himself. Well, the fraternity also, by the following fall, had, for some reason and somehow, just how I don't exactly recall, except that probably because the fraternity brother was on the staff of the humor magazine called The Octopus, and knowing that I was in part a journalist and was already working on the Daily Cardinal, he got me to be kind of a promotion person, advertising person for promoting the sale of the Octopus Humor Magazine. And that fall, there came along what seemed to be fairly characteristic of the 20s, the so-called homecoming parade, with the theme often being the oncoming hoped for union building.
Oh.
And so I was given the job of designing a float for the Octopus with a Memorial Union theme to it. And did do that. It was an old Ford which we dressed up. And still have a photograph of it. It was on the theme of give to the Union, support the Memorial Union campaign, and so on. And I got a telephone call the night after the parade saying this float had won first prize. So I thought well of the Union at that point, too. Well, these were my two first introductions to what was an ongoing student effort to get a union building for this campus. There were annual fundraising campaigns among students. One of the remarkable things in the background of this building and this union development was the outpouring of interest and funds by students to get this building to happen. And as you've probably seen in our literature during the 1920s, about one out of every two students pledged and paid, some did not pay in the end, but most did, $50 or more for a life membership in the Memorial Union.
That was a lot of money at that
and
time.
$50 in the 1920s would be the equivalent of around $250 in today's dollars. So when half the st- understood body comes forth with that kind of interest and support. You could tell something was happening. And there was great excitement about the prospects of having a union, because everybody knew what I've told you, and that is that life was pretty grim on this campus unless you lived in fraternity and sorority. And one of the advertised benefits of having a union would be that there would now be a general social meeting place for everybody. It'd be a place to eat and a place to find your friends and talk, and ultimately there would be a theater. And, so there was an air of excitement about it all, and on the part of students who came to realize that it would never be built while they were still in school, and therefore they could see that they weren't going to be the users of it, but they wanted it to happen for their student successors,
so,
and
they,
for whatever benefit it might be when they came back as alumni.
So they still contributed the money, even though they knew they would not benefit from.
Right. And in the end, students contributed more money to build this building than alumni did, which is another interesting facet of our financial history. Well, I was only peripherally related to the union in the two ways that I mentioned in the beginning, because my other impulses for out-of-class activity ran to the Daily Cardinal and to the Hareswood Club. Case of the Daily Cardinal, I moved up the ladder. I was on it for 4 years and ultimately became the editor-in-chief. And concurrently with that, this business of appearing in Union Vaudeville had attracted the attention of the Hareswood show people. You familiar with Hareswood?
Oh, yes.
See the special feature articles last week?
Yes.
Cap Times Carol came in and interviewed me about that. And as a result of the Union Vaudeville appearance, somebody nudged me to try out for the Hareswood show in my second year, sophomore year. You weren't eligible in your freshman year. And I seemed to make it because I was one of a few that apparently carry a tune at that time and was small enough to get a borrowed dress from Della Gamma House and a pair of shoes that the girls loaned me, and so on. So Hareswood became a major interest for the succeeding years, sophomore, junior, and senior year.
You stayed with it then?
Pardon?
You stayed with it?
Yeah, each year, and became president of the Hareswood Club in my senior year, and then continued on in the first graduate year by writing a book for the Hareswood show called Ivanhoe, and some of the lyrics and the Hareswood Serenade song, and so on and so on. Well, these two major activities, Cardinal and the Hareswood show, I guess on hindsight, you could say, did have some direct connection with the union in the end, and what happened at the union, because the Cardinal editor was obviously someone that the Memorial Union fundraising group wanted to enlist for support of the student campaigns and support of the union idea. So I was one of each succeeding editorial staff that was so enlisted and persuaded that it was an enormously good thing to have happen. So therefore, many editorials written by me and my associates in support of the union venture, and anything related to the union got front page play and a real public relations boost from Cardinal, and partly for self-interest reasons too, because the Daily Cardinal had no offices worth mentioning. They operated out of a couple of rooms, not much larger than the two rooms we're sitting in here. They were in the so-called Old Union Building, a private residence, and the Daily Cardinal was in one or two of the bedrooms up on the second floor. So we knew, as Daily Cardinal people, that the union was going to provide office space and access to all the other student organizations that would be housed in the union. And instead of having to search them out, try to find them moving around the campus or by telephone. And then in the case of the Harrisfoot shows, we had the very difficult, distressing experience of trying to find a place to rehearse. The rehearsals started in, say, December, or show in April, and we took any church basement or women's club rooms or ballroom downtown, wherever we could find a place for the dance chorus to rehearse, the orchestra to rehearse, and not to mention putting the show together for dress rehearsals, which had to happen at the old Fuller Opera House, later called the Parkway, after the last movie show was over.
Late.
Two nights before we opened the show, we could get on stage at the Parkway about midnight and for a dress rehearsal, and we would finish up the rehearsal maybe at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning.
It had to be limited to
the time after the last movie at the Parkway Theater, namely got dressed and on stage about midnight and on to 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and then we kept second night, and then we're out on the road for what amounted to about a 10-day trip through the Middle West with just this much stage experience on stage to put the show together. So the Harrisfoot Club as a whole was a strong supporter of the union because they saw the possibility of a on-campus theater coming. The theater wing was shown as part of the union physical plant as early as 1920 or 21.
Oh, it was.
So there was no theater worthy of the name at that time, and never had been. The nearest thing to it was a flat floor auditorium in Lathrop Hall. Are you familiar with Lathrop Hall?
Yes.
It has a stage that lies between the women's gym on the one hand and then a small flat floor auditorium type place on the other side of the stage.
I also know that some performances were held in Bascom.
Well, that was a good deal later.
Oh, yes.
Much later. Late starting is not earlier than the late 20s or 1930s. But in the mid-20s, which we're now talking about, there was no Bascom Theater either. That was an addition to Bascom Hall that came later. So the Harrisfoot Club as a whole was on record as ardently supporting the construction of this new union. And I had had these 3 or 4 years of direct personal experience of the difficulties of trying to put a student show together. And it was an all-student enterprise. We wrote the music, we wrote the book, we designed and built the scenery ourselves, we scoured the campus for girls' dresses that would come somewhere near fitting, and a little later on we got a little more professional than that, and we began to design costumes and get them made by seamstresses and so on. But except for the director of the show production, the whole thing was a student-created extravaganza, as they used to call it, with a pit orchestra being all students and so on. Well, I guess you can see it was not hard for me on becoming union director in 1928 to continue to put forward aggressively the hope that an effort that might result in building a theater wing. The theater wing was not part of the original building. We didn't have enough money to do it. As you probably know, the first units of the building were the central social meeting unit and then the dining wing as the second. So I guess it's fair to say that my own personal experience with Harrisfoot and was a factor in putting some steam behind the effort to keep going until we got the theater wing. Well, I've talked, I guess, exclusively about out-of-class activity at college. There was also, of course, the in-class effort, and I found myself to be an English major with a minor in dramatic literature. Again, the theater interest turning up. And then upon undergraduate graduation in 1924, I continued with graduate work for as well as I could. I had a full-time job. I continued with one or two courses each term, including summers, for some 12 years.
What was the full-time job?
Well, I guess I haven't mentioned that, have I? Because I was editor of the Cardinal and had done apparently an acceptable job of promoting the union fortunes via the Cardinal, Executive Secretary of the Fundraising Committee asked me the week after I graduated to come in to the union organization as his assistant to do the publicity and promotion for the total union fundraising campaign. So in 1924 I had beginning a week after graduation, I had a full-time job. It was rather masked by the title. The title was Alumni Recorder. This was a way to get the university to pay for an assistant without drawing upon gift funds to do it, but justified because the university at that time in 1924 had no mailing list of its alumni, had no record of who its alumni were, other than their transcripts in the registrar's files, and other than the membership lists of the Alumni Association, which added up to maybe 2,000 names out of some 90,000 who had attended the university. And this was all discovered to be a vital problem because of the union fundraising campaign. The fundraisers went out to raise funds all over the United States and Wisconsin cities, and there was no way to find out what Wisconsin alumni were in a given town to call together to talk to. And so the leaders of the union campaign, two or three of which were former alumni presidents, persuaded the university to make a major investment in the creation of an alumni records office to find as many of our 90,000 former students as we could and get them on an active mailing list, not just for the purposes of the union fundraising, but for all university public relations purposes, which were critical at that time. The same year I'm talking about, 1924-25, etc., the legislature threatened a steep cut in the university budget. As I remember it, in those days it was a cut of $500,000 out of a total $5 million budget. Now that doesn't sound like much when you've got a budget of almost $1 billion for the state system now, but $5 million for the University of Madison in the middle 20s was considered, and indeed was in dollar value of then, of those days, a big sum. And the legislators thought so too, and so they set forth to cut it by 10%, which would have been devastating to the university. And so the university, and this was mainly by way of the stimulus and leadership of George Haight. Do you remember George Haight's name?
Yes, I do.
For many years he was considered Wisconsin's number one alumnus. He was co-chairman of the union fundraising campaign, one of the members of the committee, later became chairman. At any rate, through his leadership, alumni and faculty went aggressively throughout the state of Wisconsin to tell the university story and to get citizens to write their assemblymen and senators and ask that they oppose this cut. Well, they had to have lists of names of people to call together, so this was another immediate use for this alumni records file, address file, and they had to have ammunition on the university's services and benefits to the state to use in their appeals for help. In other words, to be able to cite to farmer groups what the College of Agriculture was doing for the economy of Wisconsin agriculture, and what science, engineering were doing for industry in the state and so on. So besides the direct publicity promotion function for the union campaign, I and my chief, who was John Dougherty, the executive secretary of the fundraising committee, went from department to department, much as you're doing on oral history to find out from each department what their services to the state were and what the outcome was. And as an outcome of this, we prepared a speaker's manual setting forth in digest form what the benefits to the state, economically, socially, social welfare, citizen leadership, and in science and medicine and engineering were, so that these benefits could be conveyed to the citizenry and persuade them in turn to persuade their legislators not to cut out this $500,000. And happily, this effort succeeded. The cut was not made. Well, you asked what full-time job. This was the full-time job for the first 2 years. And then John Dollard, who had asked me to come in to help, and whom I roomed with, was asked to become the assistant to the president at the University of Chicago. Max Mason, who was a physicist here on our faculty, and was supposed to have been the heir apparent to President Burge and be president of the University of Wisconsin. But the progressive regents, the Progressive Party regents, led by the La Follettes and Governor Blaine, Zona Gale, and others, chose instead Glenn Frank. And this is a story all by itself, which I'll maybe come to later if we want to talk about our relations with the administration as to what happened at this crucial point in the university's history, which I guess is little known in your archives. But anyhow, Mason, not chosen, was within a matter of days almost selected by the University of Chicago, which was an institution of higher education of some repute also. And he took with him John Dollard in 1926 as his assistant. And at that point, Dollard and the Memorial and Building Committee, which was raising funds, asked me to take Dollard's place as Executive Secretary and Campaign Director. So, beginning in 1926, I embarked on first the fundraising job. And by the way, continued as the fundraiser until this moment. In other words,
you've never stopped.
50 years of it. And this involved also getting moving on the completion of the drawings for the Union Building, the planning of it, and the rest of the fundraising for it. And so on. And it was during this period of time, with a so-called full-time job, that I also was taking graduate courses in art history. And this was because I went to Dean Slichter, who was dean of the graduate school, to say that I wanted to keep contact with what happened in the classroom, and I thought I could do a better job of working with students and with faculty if I had a continuing notion of how things went in the classroom, the mood, the reactions, the objectives, so on, and maybe I could enhance my own learning some along the way, although I had nothing particular in mind, not a degree, for example. And Schlichter came up with the news that beginning next term, Oscar Hagen was being brought from Göttingen, Germany, to create a new department of art history. That he was a good man, they never had an art history department before, that he would be glad to have graduate students, that there were no undergraduates ready to move into his seminars or graduate program because there were no art history courses, except maybe an isolated thing here and there in Greek and Roman history and so on, classical architecture, for example. And I said, well, I don't know anything about art or art history. And he said, well, we can't be choosers other than anybody else, and why don't you try it and see what happened? So I did. I was the first graduate student in art history, therefore, as it turned out. Before the semester was over, there were three of us. And we sat in a seminar with Hagen, and then, of course, as soon as he got going on his undergraduate courses, with his general basic courses in art history, I took one or two each term as often as I could.
Who were the other two graduate students?
Well, Clinch Calkins by name, Calkins, was one, and John Dollard in the first year. This was before he left. This all happened in the fall of 1924, 25, I forget which, 24, I think. And those were the three of us. And then a little later on, people like Jim Watrous. He graduated in 31, and in art education, and then he switched to art history after 31. So that would have been 6-7 years later. And there were relatively few students in graduate work in art history in those early years because there weren't any student moving out of undergraduate majors mm-hmm. in art history, and the department wasn't well enough known throughout the academic world for students to come here specifically for art history graduate work at that early time. Later, of course, it did happen. Well, by the time the union planning was well underway in 1927 and the building opened in 1928, I'd had this set of exposures to art and art history, and along the way I took a course in art education too, etching and aquatint and so on under Professor Farnham to see if I could do anything with my hands. Found I couldn't, but the interest was there, and so this had, again, I can see on hindsight, an impact on what we did about the union in the art field, because up to that time there was no union in this country that had an art gallery. There was one in Canada, Hart House at the University of Toronto, that had what they called a sketch room, and it was an exhibition hall or gallery, and I was familiar with this and saw that it was at least possible that a art gallery could be in a union, though no American union had ever, no U.S. union had ever done it. And with the beginning
apprehension of what art was about, and especially art history. I helped to get the plans changed so that what was a kind of reception or assembly room was converted into an art gallery.
This is before the building was even started.
In the drawing stage. Well, mainly in the equipment and furnishing stage, because it meant a different treatment of the walls for hanging pictures. It was a modest change, and actually, not knowing any better, we had a piano in the room too, to give students a chance to play classical music. See, I was beginning to get into the classical arts, both visual and sound. I had to give that up pretty shortly, give up the piano, because students didn't play classical music. They played chopsticks and assorted other disturbing sounds. Some were pretty good, but we just learned that it was a distraction to people who were trying to concentrate on the artworks to have this kind of music going in the background.
Yes, I would think so.
Up to this time, the university had never had an art gallery, so far as I can determine, of any kind. The Madison Art Association had been given a kind of a toehold on a fourth or fifth floor room in the State Historical Building for a Madison Art Association gallery. This was not university. There are a lot of university faculty personnel involved. In fact, I was myself secretary treasurer for the Madison Art Association for a number of years in the late 20s and early 30s. So, having been introduced to art and art history as I was, rather accidentally, I guess I wondered, well, why hadn't this university ever displayed art or encouraged art except as it does its art education courses, or what I think we called applied arts then, namely preparing teachers to teach art. But no exhibition potential even for them. So this notion was apparently accepted without any hassle, and we had an art gallery the day the union opened, and an art show the day the union opened, and in 1928 this is, and that continued ever since, with a steady program of art exhibitions, art lectures, competitive shows, and on and on. Well, now I better pause and let you tell me if this is enough on college days to show my entry into the union field.
I'd be interested in knowing something about the origins of the union idea and the union idea here in Wisconsin.
This, of course, is now 75 years after the first major pronouncement in favor of a union was made. So, and of course, as indicated by the previous discussion, I didn't come until 1920, so how accurately I can recall some of the circumstances, I suppose, is dubious, but there is ample documentation of it in our own archives, which could be used to verify anything that I say or to amend it. But in my reading of the history of the Union prior to my own arrival in 1920, the first mention of a union for University of Wisconsin occurred in President Van Hise's inaugural address in 1904. That's why I say it all started 75 years ago.
I see.
This year. And that address has been published in full. And in it, two or three pages are devoted to really a very eloquent appeal for a gathering place for students and faculty.